My name is John Baldridge, and I am 28 years old. Today is April 7th, 2015, and I'm speaking with Vaughn Gordy, who is my neighbor, and we were recording in his home in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
My name is Vaughn Gordy. I am 94, 95 next month, and I am enjoying this chat with my neighbor and John, and we're having a great deal of fun with it.
So Vaughn, I think I cut you short last Tuesday as we started to talk about you and your wife coming back to Mount Lebanon, but you said you wanted to maybe go back in time a little bit and talk about your time in World War II, and I'll let you start wherever you'd like to start.
Okay, sometime we'll pick up the first part there a little bit and then expand it a little bit. World War II was a four-year block in my life that I hadn't expected, and consequently, when I get into memory lane, I always refer my memories to the events of war. And but I never really put down the an actual experience. I think somewhere earlier we spoke about going across the South Atlantic and going into Africa and crossing the Mediterranean into Italy and land. When we landed in Italy, we were housed in tents. There was no formal facilities there, and consequently the four officers, the pilot, the co-pilot, the bombardier, and the navigator all bedded down in the same tent, and the rest of the crew in another part of the field in their tent. The experience there that I want to relate to is the moment of truth in my life. And I'll get to that as we go down the line. Unfamiliar to just what the practice was, I learned very quickly that you get in a plane and you join the crowd and then you go. And first thing you know, I've had my first mission. And it was an exciting experience. I don't remember the target for that particular day, but it was the same routine every day. Well, you'd be set down a day or two and pick it up there. But I flew 50 missions in a period of maybe 2 months, something like that.
Can you remind me what your job was?
Yes, and that's an interesting point, John. I'm glad you brought it up. When we were in training here in the States, celestial navigation was a key part of the thing because the war was going on strong over in England, and they were flying all night missions. So they wanted to prepare us for night missions, and the last quarter of my learning experience was celestial navigation. And that's kind of interesting because when we got over there, they changed the whole philosophy. The 8th Air Force up in England decided that night flying was just not the right thing to do. We're losing too many planes and whatnot, and we'll try to accomplish our goals by daylight flight. Excuse me. So when we got over there, it was all daylight missions, and all my training as a celestial navigator went down the drain, because that when somebody say to me on the crew, where are we going? And I tell them, this followed the plane in front of you. And that was so much the navigation. But navigation becomes very key, particularly when you have a problem and or you're shot down or you're damaged. The rest of the flights, the rest of the flight crews are going home, and you can't keep up with them because of an injury or something to the plane. And that's the story I want to get to in just a moment. It seems like Mr. Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, is dictating from London what the 15th Air Force should be doing. And of course, we had no choice because the targets were picked out for us. And one particular target was the town of Ploiești in Romania. And the reason was that they were producing all of the fuel for all of their German equipment in Ploiești, because the source of oil and whatnot there, it was very good. So a flight to Ploiești was very key to our missions, because it would knock out a lot of the possibilities of the Germans to do what they want to do with tanks, with airplanes, with trucks, with anything that they do. Is if you can get their fuel line broken, why, you're going to make a big step. So let me get down to a mission to Ploiești. And it was the most dangerous mission that we ever flew. And it's the only target of which I was involved four times. Usually we'd go out and we accomplish whatever we had to do, and we look around for the next target, blah, blah, blah. And it became paramount to finally knock out Ploiești. And that's an interesting story, too. It's been well covered and reported. The first Ploiești raid was made from Africa, North Africa, where they practiced, and then put on a huge mission to go in from Africa across the Mediterranean, across the lower part of Europe to get to Ploiești. But it turned out that it was a very sad situation because they got lost. And but they continued to drop their bombs on secondary targets and whatnot. But that's history. Anybody wants to look into Ploiești, that was it. So when the American forces moved over from Africa to Sicily and then to Italy, we picked up that target for our main thing, our main mission. And on each of the missions that we flew, they always knew we were coming. How and when, I don't know, but I guess there was communication from one German's held position to another that the Air Force is, the 15th Air Force is headed in your direction, and blah, blah, blah. Excuse the words, blah, 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 I know better. Let me tell you about one particular mission. My 45th mission was a moment of truth. we went over the target, and we got hit badly. They knocked out two of our engines and riddled our gas tanks. We were losing gas. So we were in trouble. And the planes ahead of us that weren't hit, of course, circled over the city and headed back to Italy. We couldn't keep up with them. So we, this is when the navigation became important, because I had to direct the flight back and give the pilot the instructions he needed. And as we came to the coast of the Adriatic, the pilot and the engineer got their heads together and decided that going on is going to be risky, and it's going to be a situation where we may or may not make it. And therefore, the pilot told the crew, if there anybody wants to bail out, I'll circle the shoreline here and you can jump out. And there was a unanimous consent that, no, let's take a chance. So with that in mind, we took out and went out to go from the coastline at Yugoslavia to cross over the Adriatic to Italy and home base. And we got about, a good guess would be maybe 20 miles, 20 or 30 miles out over the sea, when the pilot suddenly came on the intercom and said, we're going to ditch. And that was a shock, you know, because this could be a death threat to all of us if we have to ditch, because ditching is not really a favorite pastime of anybody in an airplane, and particularly a B-24. So when we went down, there was a big crash, and I personally was knocked out, temporarily anyhow, and I find myself in a little compartment behind the pilot where the navigator operated. After the plane settled down in the water, and I had water up to my neck here, and only my head was above the water, and it was sinking fast. The ship was going down in the water, and I was unaware where anybody else was. I saw nobody. I was in the plane alone, in my opinion. And it turns out that the tail gunner had been killed in the crash, and it was in the back of the plane. But I was the last one out of the plane, and I didn't know whether I would be out, get out. But what happened was is that nine of the 10-man crew got out, and, well, eight of them got out and into the ocean in rubber rafts. They got their rafts out that are there for emergency and so forth and so on. Now then, my personal problem was I'm looking at the possibility I'm going to drown. There's just nothing I can do about it. And I have, the only thing I could see to do was that there was an astrodome up above my head, which you use in celestial navigation, and I tried to punch it out. I couldn't. I tried twice to get up there and punch it out. I couldn't. And then comes the moment of truth. Is this it? Is it all over? And whatnot. I was desperate, nothing I could do. I couldn't move, I couldn't make any contact with that astrodome. But just as the water continued to rise and I was facing drowning with no way to avoid it, the Astrodome popped open. And what had happened is that the engineer on the craft, an enlisted man, came back because he knew where I would possibly be, and he got on top of the ship that was sinking fast and popped the Astrodome, and I saw daylight, and
wow.
And it was a means of getting out. And with his help pulling me up and I trying to struggle to lift myself out, we finally got out. And by the time I got down in the rubber raft that he had brought back to the plane to make that effort, the plane, by the time I got into the rubber raft, the plane disappeared. And it went down, and it was a remarkable thing. I often think I wish I could have someday something, say something to that engineer who did that thing. But anyhow, we're in the water now in the four or five rafts, and then we were, when I popped up and could see what was going on, there were, I saw at least four rubber rafts with most of the crews in it, and that was a relief to see that. I didn't know whether I had a bunch of fellows that had got killed in the crash or perhaps drowned. Now then, we're out in the middle of the Adriatic Ocean, and I had sent an SOS message out alerting anybody that we were in trouble. So the location of our thing was well known. And again, there was a lot of fighter pilots up in the air circling around, and they knew how to get the location down in latitude, longitude, and so forth. And now then, over the horizon, we saw a boat coming at us. It was not like a fishing craft, motorized. And it turned out it was the island of Vis, V-I-S, off of Yugoslavia. It was in the hands of those who were on our side. And they probably heard our message, and they were coming out to pick us up or to do whatever they could, or they didn't know what they would find. But as that approached, we all moved towards it, and I had my foot halfway over the rail of their boat when a PBY Navy ship was in the air right above us and was planning to land. So to make a long story short, we all, those who lived, got in the PBY and Navy airplane that is can land in the water. That's an explanation for somebody that didn't understand PBY. But this big craft can land in the water, and they did. We boarded it, and we were delivered back to our base in Italy. And all of us were examined for damage and wounds or so forth. But everybody that was on that PBY, and that was eight of us, sorry, nine of us, all but the tail gunner, who we could not rescue, the crew could not rescue him or bring out his body even. But all of us seemed to have taken a big blow when a plane crashed in the water, but no serious injuries at all. And we were examined by the doctors and cleared and so forth. And to make a long story short, if that's possible, that was my 45th mission, and I was determined to fly 50, because at 50, you get the chance to go home, go back to the States. And it's hard to explain an experience. My last mission, I flew five more missions.
After this.
And the last mission was a mission over to Athens, Greece, where a German group ship was bringing over from Africa the remnants of the German army. And it was our mission to go down into the harbor there and bomb the any crafts in the harbor that might be a troop ship for Germans. And we did that successfully. But on the way back to Italy after that particular mission, we got the same crew that we always flew in, and to explain a little bit about aircrafts, there's buttons up over the top of the pilot's head, which he can press to shut down an engine if necessary, so that the propeller doesn't drag and so forth. Well, he got up out of his seat, turned the plane over to the co-pilot, but as he got up, his head hit one of these buttons, and we all heard this engine go down. And we got kind of amused that, hey, we've been through this before. We don't want to hear any failure of engines again. But it was quickly remedied. It's just an incident that happened. So with that mission to Athens, Greece, my 50 were over, and when I landed in on our camp, or whatever we call it, where on our base in Italy, when it landed, that was the last flight I had, and I hollered whoopee and everything else, because I was finished, and I knew that now they will send me back to the States. And I've already told you a lot of stories about what happened in the States, but that was a typical mission. I should add for good information is that when we would fly over our target, we could always recognize the target ahead of time, because there'd be a black cloud over the city, and they had put up there a storm of yaks, I forget what the word is, flak up in the air, and that was what we had to fly into. Now they had to examine their flak arrangements to know what altitude is this bunch of planes coming in at, and so they had this black cloud over where they're going to move. That cloud will be moved up or down once they determine we were at 20,000 feet or 30,000 feet. And once you once you're determined to go in with your target and drop bombs, why, you had no choice to go into a flak-infested situation, and you'd see planes on all sides of you fall and go down and whatnot. You'd see your friends bailing out of a plane in the air, and it was each raid that we went in, all 50 of them, were under the same circumstances. They knew you were coming. They put up the flak. They located how high you were or low, and it was going through a lot of heat. And we had 50% casualties during my stay in there. So
with that amount of casualties, how common was it for somebody to make 50 missions to go home?
Well, I wish I had an answer to that, John, but I don't. I don't know. A casualty is something like what I just described to myself. That's a casualty because we lost a soldier. But there is the possibility, if there's 50% casualties, that some of them may be, as I describe my casualty, and we return safely and so forth. But others are, when they bail out of a plane that's on fire and has been hit, your chances are just nil when you go out in a parachute, because you're going to land in German territory or German held territory. But I can't answer your question. I don't know.
Just seems to make 50 missions seems like quite an accomplishment, given how dangerous the missions were. Within your peer group, everybody in your airplane was able to make those 50 missions besides that one gentleman and go home?
Yes.
And you were able to, did you keep in contact with those fellows once you got back to the United States?
No. A big, very, very sorry disappointment. I mean, we didn't think a whole lot about it and whatnot. I didn't even have a chance to talk to the pilot and say, where'd all the rafts, rubber rafts come from? I didn't know we had them on the plane. I made one call many months after I went home to California, where it was the home of our pilot, and had a chat with him. He was flying Pan Am aircraft as a job that he had there. But that's the only one I ever got a chance to talk to. I had a hard time locating him, but I did, and I chatted with him a little bit. But no, I'm disappointed that I couldn't, particularly how much I would love to thank the engineer, who was the little chap that came back and popped that Astrodome, but I couldn't locate him.
Given you were a young man at the time, did you or your fellow service members realize the historical significance of what you were doing at the time?
You mean the whole war?
Yes.
Well, the only significant, no, the answer is no, but we were just young people. I was 23 and 24 before I left there. The only significance we had of anything that we were doing was the fact that what we were doing may be a major part of bringing the war more favorably on the Allied side, because we knew that if we could knock out Pulaski, for instance, and they can't get fuel, they can't fly plane, they can't move tanks, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the significance, but we felt very good about the fact that we did knock out one of the main sources of their fuel. No, let me answer your question a little different. It was simply a routine that has happened, World War One and everything else. And just a young fellow, we went in, okay, what do we want to do? I got into the Air Force, and okay, what's the Air Force do? Well, they bomb in German-held territory, and so that's what we did every day.
What kind of information did you have about Hitler and what he was doing to his people at that time? What was your intel as far as that was concerned?
John, I didn't we didn't have any newspaper or anything else. The best source of information we had came from BBC, British Broadcasting. We could turn on the radio in the plane, and we always did that on our return. And when we returned, we got comfortable, we'd turn on the radio and get news. But I have to say that I've learned a lot in the last couple of years about Hitler because I've read books and so forth and so on. I've even read a book written by a German fighter pilot who tells his story, et cetera, et cetera. But we had no idea at that point that there was the Holocaust. And is that the name?
Yeah.
The Jews being imprisoned, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we didn't know anything about that.
Is there anything you want to, anything further you want to talk about as far as World War II?
No, let's put it this way. World War II took 4 years out of my life, and I can't say that I was sorry. There's a lot that went on. There's a lot of relationships that were developed, and there's a lot of the world that I got to see in the airplane. But nothing that really occurred at the time, as opposed to what I've read since the war. And I think it's interesting if you could spend the time as a, you know, the 8th Air Force is out of England, and they lived in nice barracks, and they go to London anytime they wanted, and so forth and so on, but there in Italy, we simply took over an airstrip that the Germans had used in the African War, and we lived, as I said earlier, we lived in tents, and an exciting event would be that on a day off, I'd take the Jeep and go in town and take some dirty clothes in. And there was a family in there that took care of all that for me, and I became very well acquainted with the metropolitan city of Cerignola, which is nothing but a big Catholic church surrounded by some homes that didn't even have water. It's a very poor little town, but they were very nice people, and I got to chat with them and made friends with them, and they were very thrilled with the approach or the residency of the 15th Air Force as opposed to the German Army, which had preceded us in using that space down there. But Chernobyl is an interesting little town. They had no water. Everybody wanted water. You went to the town well, pump, and get your water, and so forth and so on. But it had a beautiful Catholic church in the center of this town, and typically, I guess that's the situation all over southern Italy, is that you put up the church and then people come and do it. But they were nothing but poor farmers, and mostly. Our base, incidentally, was in the middle of an olive orchard, and all around us we could see evidence of a farmer trying to strive to do, make a living, and while we did our business.
What was the first thing that you did when you came back to the United States after your time in service?
I think we covered that, John. I got on a train in Norfolk. I came back on a boat, on a troop boat. And incidentally, on a troop boat, we crossed the South Atlantic, which was still a very dangerous area for German submarines, et cetera, et cetera. But when I got to Norfolk, I called June on the phone and said, I'm here and I'm back and I'm going to get on a train. I'll be in on the West Coast in the next 3 or 4 days. Most of the people, I called my parents too and talked to them, and I told them what I was going to do. But of course, most of them had a family that they were going back to, but I was going back to get married and went to Monterey, and I think I might have mentioned that before, Monterey, and then up to Sacramento, and we got married in the Grace Episcopal Church, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, Vaughn, that brings us close to our 40 minutes here, and it's actually perfect because it brings us back to last week, and next week we can start there if you'd like.
Okay, that'd be fine. I'm so glad to get that war story off.